Accession number 20937, Reel 1.
Neville Howell, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Great Yarmouth.
Which year was this?
1922.
Did both your mother and father come from Great Yarmouth?
Yes, both mother and father, Great Yarmouth.
What did your father do for a living?
He did various jobs, including catering for the holiday crowd who came to Great Yarmouth during the summer months, namely fixing them up with coach travel. And during the winter months, he worked at the sugar beet factory, Cantley.
Did you go to school in Great Yarmouth?
Yes, I went to school in Great Yarmouth.
Which one?
I started off at St. George's Infant School. Then I went to the Great Yarmouth Hospital School.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
13 years, almost 14. The reason being that my birthday, falling on the 24th of December, we broke up for the Christmas holidays before my 14th birthday, and that was the last of school as such.
Did you get a job on leaving school?
No, I had worked before I left school as a butcher's boy, and shortly after leaving school, in fact 25 days later, I was in the army.
Why did you want to join the army?
It wasn't so much that I wanted to join the army, but because of family conditions, my father decided that he would, when the boys were old enough, that they would go into the army. This was partly because of the restricted sleeping arrangements at home, where there was a family of four boys and three girls.
How did you feel about going in the army?
A bit reluctant, but I was following in my elder brother's footsteps. He had preceded me by about 18 months or so, so I knew what to expect in a way. My father had also been a military man during the First World War, and being brought up, if you like, in that type of atmosphere, although I was reluctant, I didn't know of any other way out. I didn't feel like putting up too much resistance to my father. And my brother, who was a very good soldier, apparently, when he came on leave, he told me that many things about the boys' depot, and so I understood what I was going to.
What would you have preferred to have done rather than going to the army?
Well, at that age, I hadn't made up my mind what I would have done, no.
Had your father been a regular?
No, he'd just served during the First World War.
Which unit had he been in?
The Norfolks.
Did you join the Norfolks?
No, but the Norfolk Depot was situated at the Britannia Barracks in Norwich. And I had to go there to the barracks in Norwich when I was 13 years old. When I was about 13 and a half, I had to go there to have a preliminary medical exam and mental exam. And then I was informed, before I was 14, of when I would have to report again to the Britannia Barracks. And I reported there on the due date, which was the 18th of January 1937, and the following day I was sworn in and received the King's shilling, and I had to sign attestation papers which threatened me with prison if any information I had given was wrong, and here I was just 14 and 25 days old. I was then given a warrant, a railway warrant, and dispatched to Woolwich. I had to make my own way there. I arrived in Woolwich, where I was met on the station by garrison police, who conducted me to the boys' depot, Royal Artillery. And there, I was destined to spend 12 months learning not only marching, but sounding with the bugle and trumpet prior to passing out as a trumpeter, Royal Artillery.
What was this initial training like for you?
Very strict, indeed. Very strict.
Can you give an example?
I can. We were on parade at 6 o'clock in the morning, or soon after. And sometimes we wouldn't finish with training until 9 o'clock in the evening. We had to sort ourselves out. We had to submit to all forms of discipline. Compulsory boxing was one example. I will add that we also had to do normal schooling, which also included subjects which wouldn't be taught at the schools I'd been to as a child. I was still a child, but this included things like map reading and that type of thing. And we had to do enough schooling. Some of it was compulsory, voluntary schooling in the evening in order to obtain our certificates of education. First of all, the third class certificate of education, then the second class of education. These we had to obtain or we wouldn't be allowed to leave the depot. And we were all keen to get away from the depot, of course, because of the very strict conditions there. Another example, if you like, should we, any of us, have been caught smoking, we were taken before the commanding officer. And without exception, we were made to strip to the waist and we were hit with a cane across the back. If people were caught a second time, and I only knew of one person who was caught a second time, then the punishment was trebled. And I saw the result of that, which was bleeding slashes across the back.
Did you get this punishment?
No, I didn't. No.
Did you resent this strict discipline?
No, because this was fully expected. No, no. I've no doubt that today would be a different matter, but no. Fully expected.
Do you think it did you any good?
I'm certain it did no harm.
What happened next?
Well, at the end of 12 months, along with the people who had been taken in with my batch of recruits, at the end of 12 months, passed all sorts of tests, including, of course, one of the primary ones was sounding bugle and trumpet calls. We had to know all the bugle and trumpet calls from the army, not just for the Royal Artillery, but those that are used by other units. And yes, having passed the test, we were then dispatched to our various units. Mine being back to Norwich, to the what was then the cavalry barracks in Norwich, Nelson Barracks, situated on Barrack Road. And there was a field regiment of the Royal Artillery.
These bugle calls, did you put words to them?
We had ditties, yes, to some of them. For instance, fire call, we would sing out to ourselves, if you like. This is a simple one. There's a fire, there's a fire, there's a fire. Fetch a bucket of water, come and put it out. That's a fire call. There were others. We had to know calls from the others. And another one that comes to mind is the Royal Horse Artillery. And the ditty to that was, the Royal Horse Artillery, the pride of the army, the first on the field and the last to retire. So, there were several more, of course.
Can you remember any more?
Well, I can, but this is short notice. Obviously, the one calling us to to our meals, if you like, come to the cookhouse store, boys, come to the cookhouse store. Right. And another one comes to mind, a short one, the alarm call, if you like. There's a stranger in the camp, there's a stranger in the camp. But, you know, that's...
So you went to the field regiment, you said, in Norwich?
That's right, yes.
Which one was that?
I can't remember offhand. This annoys me that I can't remember exactly which field regiment it was. I wish I could remember which one it was, but I just can't.
What duties did you have with this field regiment?
Well, primarily a trumpeter, sounding all the calls throughout the day when on duty. Used to parade with the guard going on duty, and you were on duty then for 24 hours with the guard in case of being called out to sound a fire call. But we used to sound last post, reveille, first post, and all the other calls, retreat, etc. Calls throughout the day.
How long had you signed on for?
I signed on to do 9 years with the colours and 3 years reserve as from attaining the age of 18. So the first 4 years that I did not count towards my service. This was the minimum that one trumpet could sign on for.
How were boys treated in this unit in Norwich?
Oh, it was a lot easier than the boys' depot, a lot easier. I mean, let me say, we were taken care of. We were looked after, if you like. We were in a barrack room with no men, as opposed to all boys. But the NCO in charge of the barrack room kept a good eye on you. And yes, any advice you wanted, there was a senior trumpeter in the regiment who could advise on what you had to do, what to look out for, etc. And also, these NCOs in the barrack room saw to it that, although we didn't need a lot of watching, because we knew we'd soldiered for 12 months and we were, if you like, knew how to look after our kit, how to dress, etc., and how to conduct ourselves.
What do you remember happening next?
Along with, as I believe was the common thing for trumpeters, they also had other roles to play. One of them in the old days when there were a lot of horses about was as the, perhaps the battery sergeant major's horse holder or something like that, when on manoeuvres and so on. In my case, the trumpeters were also being taught as signallers, where we had to learn how to signal with a lamp, how to signal with flags, Morse key, early radios. We had to be able to handle all those, field telephone, and the normal job again of a trumpeter within a battery when on manoeuvres was gun position signaller, which meant that you were tied down on a field telephone and in communication with your battery. You could be in communication with regiment. And another thing, when and I experienced this myself, was also to liaise with the Lysander aircraft flown by the RAF, so that they used to do spotting for us. They could talk one way by radio, or they could drop a little bag with a message in it, and as a signaller, I was able to put out what were known as ground strips on the floor, which the pilot could read. That was one of the memories of going on manoeuvres as a trumpeter and battery position signaller, yeah.
Did you at this time think a war was coming?
Oh, not early on when I joined the regiment. No, I joined the regiment in January 1938. Although not long after that, I can remember there was the first, I believe, referred to as the first scare, if you like, that there might be something in that in line. And this resulted in, for whatever reason, I don't know, all our field guns were taken away. We were issued with searchlights, and people from the Royal Engineers came and showed us how to operate the searchlights. So for about, I should think, the best part of 12 months, the regiment, which had previously had field guns, now had searchlights, and we used to go out at night time around Norwich with our searchlights. And I still remember, you know, how to operate that particular type of searchlight.
How do you operate them?
Well, we had big lorries which were able to provide power for the searchlight. And the searchlights had an operator on the ground. There was a long arm from the searchlight which stretched out to one side, and orders could be given by spotters how to operate, what to do to control the searchlight, both its height and its direction. And the orders would be given out in a peculiar manner. If somebody wanted you to traverse round to the right, they would say, right, right, right quick. And that would indicate what speed they wanted you to go round. And the similar orders were given for elevating the light itself. So it would be up slowly, up a bit quicker and up quick. Those were the orders that were given to the what was called the long arm projection controller. He was the man on the end of the arm with a little wheel for turning the thing up or walking or running round. That was the searchlights, yes. That's how they were operated.
What type of field guns had been replaced?
The field guns had were 18 pounders.
What do you remember happening next?
the next thing, I believe because of the political situation, things seemed to have cooled down, the searchlights were taken away and reissued with field guns. And then we went on manoeuvres again down to, I think it was Salisbury Plain, for the purpose of practice firing. And whilst we were there, we were suddenly ordered to return to barracks as fast as possible. And this, I believe, was because of the deepening political crisis. And we returned to barracks, and then we all had to get extra inoculations, presumably because it was anticipated that in the event of war breaking out, we would be sent abroad. And unfortunately, I was given the full dose of inoculations, and I was only small, and apparently I shouldn't have been given this full dose, and I became very ill for a couple of days as a result of it. Got over it okay, but this happened to coincide with the time when war was declared. And so I was confined to the bed in the barrack room with one man to look after me, whilst the rest of the barracks were, in the event of an alarm, air raid alarm being sounded, allowed to take cover in wherever they were ordered to. And needless to say, even that second evening, we were inoculated on the Saturday, and I became ill, very ill by the afternoon. The medical officer came to see me. I was still in bed on the Sunday, through to the Sunday evening, when in fact Norwich had its first alert and the alarm was sounded. And yes, everybody evacuated to the sheltered positions, except me. I had to stay in bed.
When you recovered, how did you feel about the war outbreak?
I suppose a certain amount of excitement, to put it mildly, yes, and anticipation.
And then?
Well, then, within a short space of time, the regiment was mobilised fully, which meant reservists came into the unit, and because I was not old enough to go abroad with the regiment, and along with the other trumpeters, we had to wave goodbye to the regiment as they took off to go across to with the BEF. So I remained behind in the Nelson Barracks, Norwich, along with a few other trumpeters and other people who were considered unfit to proceed with the regiment. And I had to stay there, waiting to see what would happen next. Eventually, the Royal Norfolks, who were in the Britannia Barracks, came and took over the Nelson Barracks as well. And I was posted to help form a regiment in Leakatoo Barracks, Colchester. In Colchester, at the barracks, other people were posted there to help form the regiment. They were mainly reservists, some territorials, and people like myself who were too young to, and had lost the regiments, if you like. The regiment that was being formed was the 36th Signal Trainer Regiment, RA.
What was this unit supposed to do?
Mainly to train, turn out new recruits as trained signallers for the Royal Artillery. This, of course, included they had to be taught how to march, how to drive or ride motorcycles, and then how to handle all the signalling equipment which was likely to be used in any units they were posted to. Their training normally consisted of about 12 or 14 weeks. They would spend a few weeks in one battery learning how to march and the essential minor things in connection with being soldiers. They would then go to another regiment where they would learn the Morse code and then learn how to drive and handle weapons. And the final battery they went to was the one which would bring them up to the classified Royal Artillery signallers. And they would then be posted on to units to act as signallers.
So were you being trained as a signaller?
No, because I was there with the earliest people forming the regiment, we were permanent staff, if you like. And I still had to continue with my duties as a trumpeter, take my turn on guard duties, and at the same time I assisted with the training of these new recruits, because I was, comparatively speaking, a very experienced soldier by then. And I, whilst there, I was given the first stripe on my arm, even though I was only 16. And I continued helping to train these recruits coming in. But like I say, I still had to carry on taking my turn on guard duty as a trumpeter. And we were like that. Oh, the other thing we had to do, again, in which I shared, was the local defence of the Colchester area. My regiment were assigned the west side of Colchester to protect. That was where the bypass ran. And one of my duties was, because I was fairly good at map reading, I had to enlarge maps of the area, showing every bush, etc., and every tree. And we were assigned posts and places on that western side of Colchester in the event of any invasion by the enemy, if you like. This included Molotov cocktails being planted in certain places and some people being detailed to climb high trees, and when the supposed German tanks passed underneath, to drop Molotov cocktails on, which now, of course, seems very comical.
So this was after the fall of France, was it?
Initially, no, of course. I mean, I went to Colchester before the thing had blown up on the continent, if you like. And yes, I was still there when France fell, yes. And yes, of course, we know that everywhere there was a possible invasion by the enemy, and of course we were often placed on the equivalent of red alert in case an invasion was taking place.
Did you see anything of the troops coming back from Dunkirk?
No, I did not see anything of the troops coming back from Dunkirk, no. Not whatsoever, no.
Did you feel that the Germans would invade in 1914?
I had no particular feeling about it, whether they would invade or not. I witnessed many times the aircraft crossing the coast to raid London. I can remember in particular one day when, I don't know how many aircraft there were, but they were literally stacked up in the sky, the German aircraft. And I watched one lone plane dive on them. I heard the machine gun fire, and the lone plane then continued, and I saw that it was a Hurricane, and it just carried on and hit the ground. That was one occasion. On another occasion, a lone German bomber, I believe a Dornier or something like that, flew very low over Colchester, machine gunning the Colchester streets. But that was about the only enemy activity, of course.
Were you anywhere near the streets that were being strafed?
Oh, what? Not at the time, no. We had machine gun posts rigged up on which were mounted Lewis guns for protection against aircraft, but they were not manned at that time. I do remember another event when I was on duty as a trumpeter. You slept in the guard room with the rest of the guard, of course, when you were on duty. And about midnight, a bombardier came into the guard room. He'd been out for the evening. He came into the guard room, bringing some fish and chips with him for the guard. This was a kind of regular occurrence. And he then departed. He was quartered in Nissen Hut, in a section of Nissen Huts, which had recently been built. And about 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, somebody came into the guard room to say the Nissen Huts were on fire. I had to turn out, and I went round every barrack block. The Nissen Huts were had been built a little bit away from the main barrack area. And I went around sounding the fire call. I sounded it 30 times. I managed to sound it 30 times. And then I went across to where the fire was. The Nissen Huts were well ablaze. There was Nissen Huts, I suppose there are about perhaps 20 of them, built in a spider so that there was a central corridor and the huts were off to each side. They were all wood. They'd virtually brand new. They were occupied. And everybody got out, except that one bombardier who'd left us departed from the guard room. He was the only one who didn't get out. His name was Black, and yes, I attended his funeral later, and I remember his father turned up. His father was in Home Guard uniform when he turned up for the funeral. But yes, that was, and I had to give evidence for the Court of Inquiry or whatever it was that took place.
How had the fire started?
It was suspected that Bombardier Black had lit a cigarette and had fallen asleep. He had obviously been drinking. But yes, the other thing was about that, we did have our own fire picket who had a little peculiar fire engine on which they used to drill under a sergeant. It was rather comical. This was such an old contraption, and the pumps had to be primed with the water. Pumps had to be primed with water. The engine had to be primed with petrol to get it working correctly. On this occasion, it was trundled across to the nearest they could get to the fire itself. And although it would have been hopelessly inadequate, the comical part of it was that they made the mistake of priming the water pumps with the petrol and vice versa, so the thing didn't work at all. Not that it would have done any good at all. We were next to the cavalry barracks. The 17th, 21st Lancers were alongside us, and yes, we used to watch them learning the new recruits how to ride horses. That's one of the things I often thought, that they were for new recruits being brought in at that time. Obviously some of them were conscripted. They were being made to ride these horses and jump them over logs with their arms folded, and it must have been terrifying, I would think, for some of them.
And then?
Well, then it was decided that our regiment would move out from those barracks. An advanced party of Australians turned up to take over the barracks from us. And again, a little incident here. The Australians were not very well disciplined, and they were a rather tough lot and independent. And of course, things were very strict regarding the amount of light that was shown at night time and that type of thing. Well, these Australians, there were only a few of them, and they were occupied just one barrack room, which was upstairs, if you like, in one of the barrack blocks. This applied to nearly all of them, because the old barrack blocks were built with the stables down below and the barrack rooms up top. And I can remember one occasion, again I was on duty, when they were showing a lot of lights upstairs late at night. They'd been out drinking, they came back and their lights were on, and our orderly officer was turned out and went with a bombardier from the guard, went to tell them to put the lights out. And when they went, they had to go upstairs to tell them to put the lights out.